Welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, as Mr. Mangan just said. We are also on the internet at cjsf.ca and TELUS HD channel 7014. It's an uber-fantastic show today. Yes, uber-fantastic. And we have a great, great, socially conscious stand-up comedian, Hori Kondabolu. He'll be talking about his stand-up album, his tour, his style of comedy, and all that. Really, really good. He made a really great video of the Washington Redskins name controversy about a month or so back. I highly recommend you check it out. You'll also be hearing from David Alvarado and Jason Susberg. They are the directors of the documentary The Immortalists, which follows two scientists, Aubrey de Grey and and his colleague. And they are basically trying to cure aging. So that's something really cool. And then you'll also hear from Chris Caraba and his new music project, Twin Forks. So it's going to be an action-packed show today. Excuse me. And we're actually going to start with a song from Twin Forks' self-titled debut LP. And this is the song Back to You, which happened to be featured in CW's show Rain. Back to You by Twin Forks.
I was young, so I forgot which was my place and which was not. Thought I had a good shot.
To You by Twin Forks, and you'll be hearing from Twin Forks' Chris Caraba, formerly of Dashboard Confessional, a little later on in the program. But right now, my first guest is a wonderfully talented stand-up comedian who was also a writer and correspondent for the Chris Rock-produced Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. He is also the APA Institute's Artist-in-Residence for the 2014-2015 academic year at NYU. He co-hosts the mostly improvised talk show, the untitled Kundabalu Brothers Project, with his younger brother, Ashok, who is from the hip-hop group Das Racist, and they also host the podcast, the untitled Kundabalu Brothers Podcast. He was a former video blogger for World Compass, a joint initiative between WGBH Boston, PBS, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And he's a smarty pants, too. He has a BA in Comparative Politics, which he got in 2004, and a Master's in Human Rights from the London School of Economics in 2008. His dissertation was on Mexican returnees as internally displaced people, an argument for the protection of economic migrants under the UN Guiding Principles on Internal Displacement. His YouTube video on the Washington Redskins naming controversy, titled A Creative New Way to Help People Understand How Racism Works, went viral last month. His debut stand-up album is Waiting for 2042, which was released in March on indie label Kill Rockstars. He is Hurry Kundabalu, and I talked to him last week. This is my chat with the wonderful Hurry Kundabalu.
I am joined on the phone by comedian Hurry Kundabalu. Hurry, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So, from what I've read about you, you're a very interesting guy. You were, you know, you have a degree in politics, a degree in human rights. You were working as a rights, immigration rights, before you were discovered. Immigrant rights, excuse me. Why go into comedy? Why use comedy as an outlet to talk about these issues?
Well, let me answer your second question first. I mean, I don't think I really use comedy like as a vehicle to talk about these things. Maybe it becomes that, but it's not my intention. I talk about what I talk about who I am, and I talk about what I find interesting in the world, and it's an honest reflection of who I am, and that's why I do it. You know, it's not like one day I woke up and I'm like, I need to talk about this, this, and this. It's more like, you know, as I evolved as a person, these topics get addressed because that's what I think about all the time. And second, I guess secondly, which is really firstly, comedy was always a part of my life. It wasn't like all of a sudden I started doing it. I thought about it. I did it in high school. I did it throughout college. It's always been something I've done, and I was living in Seattle around 2005. I was an immigrant rights organizer, and I did comedy at night. There was a really strong local scene, and I would do comedy, and I was building a following doing the stuff I was doing. And the next thing you know, it led to an appearance at the HBO Comedy Festival and Jimmy Kimmel Live, which I never expected to be on television or have a manager or anything else. I did it because I love to do it, and it actually was a hobby that actually became a thing, became a career. So, you know, it wasn't like a clear, I'm, you know, doing this and I'm not doing this. I mean, there was some choice after I got the Master's in Human Rights, which was after I had been on TV and all this other stuff. I went to grad school anyway because I didn't know why this comedy stuff was happening. I knew that I loved performing, and I knew that I always wanted to do it, but the idea of it being a professional thing was a bit shocking. I didn't expect any of those breaks to happen, but when they did happen, I certainly took them. But it wasn't like a, it's kind of a gradual thing. I didn't just suddenly stop. I kind of was like, it's time.
Yeah. So you have an album out, Waiting for 2042, and you've got some interesting topics on it. So what is Matthew McConaughey have to do with the white Jesus? Are they one and the same? That could be argued that
I think that I think Matthew McConaughey is very well intentioned, and I think that's the nicest way of putting that. I think he's a very well intentioned person, and I think he has an interview in The Advocate before his film Magic Mike where he talks about you know, gay rights, and he talks about like gay people in the most bizarre way, like in a very objectifying kind of way, and it's clearly a dude that means well but doesn't really know what he's doing. He even like has an idea for an after school program to support kids who are bullied, and the way he talks about it, like, you know, it's a program to support like the gay kid, the kid with the hair lip, you know, the fat girl, and it's like language that's really absurd. But it's like for this guy, it's like, well, you know, I meant well. You know, I feel like sometimes it's important to listen to people who are oppressed and are dealing with difficult things, and not just like talk about what you're going to do or share your opinions. I feel like that's always the hardest thing when you have any degree of power over someone else. It's listening. It's that maybe, you know, our opinions aren't the most important. And I realize it's ironic to say, considering my job is, hey, my opinions are important. But yeah.
And I gotta ask about how Weezer broke your heart.
Oh, Weezer was my favorite rock group. It's funny, these are all leading questions. Yeah, Weezer was my favorite rock group in the 90s, and I still think those first two records hold up. Like that's a cuckoo clock behind me that's now making noise. They're my favorite rock group. The Blue Album and Pinkerton were incredible albums, and I think around 2001 on, they started releasing these albums I just don't understand anymore. They just don't sound like the band that I grew up listening to, and they just felt very forced. It felt like they were trying to hit some kind of mainstream popularity, and they just stopped like making music that I could understand. So it was just like, oh, alright. It felt like when I was a young person, it felt like they were writing music about like mid-20-something, and then when I became a mid-20-something, it felt like all the music was for children.
Now, I know you've done, you've worked with your brother doing an improvised talk show, the Kondabalu Brothers Project, and I'm curious for you as a comedian, how you find improv different than stand-up?
I think that, first of all, the improvisation I do is with my brother, so it's basically having a conversation with my brother, so I wouldn't say that it's pure improv, you know what I mean? It is, but it's like under a very specific set of situations. Like most improvisers, like they're not working with their siblings, you know, so that's the big difference. I don't do it anywhere else, really. But from, you know, if it's like improvising on a stage, let's say during my stand-up act, all of a sudden I'll start talking, you know, off the cuff. I will say those moments are the freest moments, and those are the moments where both me and the audience, there's a level of danger and excitement because you don't know where I'm going to go. They know I don't know where I'm going. And I think that leads to some really magical moments. Or it could lead to complete failure. Like, I've improvised and thrown off a show because my judgment was wrong about something. Or, you know, I called something out in a room that I thought was funny and it wasn't what I thought it was and I didn't know what to do. Like, those things happen. Those are the risks. With me and my brother, you know, it's very easy when we're on stage together to riff off each other. He holds me accountable and honest in a way that, you know, stand-up crowds don't necessarily do. Because, you know, I feel like when I'm on stage, sometimes it's clear I'm telling a joke. You know, like, especially when it's something I've done a million times. Like, it sounds like, oh, this sounds like a structure of a joke. He sounds like he's telling a joke. He sounds like he's said this before. With my brother, if I do anything like that, he'll call me out. Like, what are you doing? Like, talk like a real person. I just think it leads to a more honest performance because there's always someone who's going to make you honest, who forces you to get out of whatever comfortable area you're in.
So your album is called 2042, and a lot of people have said, oh, well, that's because it's the year whites are set to become a minority. Why did you want to call your album that? What was it about that time frame that was appealing to you?
I mean, I think it is interesting because I think the media keeps referring to that year when whites will be the minority. And, it, you know, 2042 is the year I've heard the most often, and there's been other figures as well. But I just find it interesting that that's something people are waiting for in any way or worried about, or it's this this racial paranoia. You know, and on the album I talk about how absurd that is, because race is not a real thing. It's such a, you know, it's a thing that we reinforce, society reinforces, but it, you know, racism is real, and the experience of people you know, who are oppressed is real, and it's because race is forced upon them, so then the reality of them being oppressed by these forced labels is real. But, like, the actual things are not real, you know what I mean? Like, and I talk about how whiteness isn't real, and how there was a time where the Irish weren't white and the Italians weren't white, and all these things were, like, they were gradual things that changed over time in different historical and social contexts. And, you know, obviously that's very long for a title, and not nearly as provocative as Waiting for 2042. And the album covers me on the back of a bicycle rickshaw being driven by an old white dude in a business suit. I think it's just more interesting visually, so I didn't want a Fiona Apple the top my first album title with, you know, like 18 sentences. So, yeah, I made it short and provocative, and the actual substance of that particular piece, you know, the song that talks about the song, the joke that talks about that first album title, it's very, you know, it's really more complicated than that.
Being a comedian, how would you describe your writing process when putting together a joke and a material? Do you test it out on people first? Do you write what's funny to you?
Yeah, I write down what's funny to me first, and sometimes I don't write it down completely. I'll write bullet points down or a key line that I think is the important line, and everything else I'll try to build on stage when I start it, just because, well, I used to write every word down, and then when I perform it, it felt stiff. It felt like I was reading. If something happened, I couldn't adjust to it because I'd been wedded to whatever thing I wrote earlier that day. So now I try to write bullet points and then have key lines and just kind of let it go. Some things, you know, I have a writing partner, and you know, it's not like we're sitting down writing everything together. It's more like I have an idea and I say to him on the phone and he gives me his feedback. And so there are certain trusted people that, like, I'll go to either for, like, the actual joke structure part of it, the, like, how to make it funnier, you know, that kind of stuff, and also, like, does my point make sense? Like, to me, like, the point, whatever the point of view of the joke has to kick upward. It has to, like, be something that, like, is hitting the right target. It has to be, I don't want to, like, the work I do is always going to be something that, like, goes after whoever has the power in the situation. If it's ever not doing that, my friends will call me out and say, that doesn't sound like you. I think you mean this more than this. Or it's an argument that just needs to be fine-tuned, because that's ultimately what a lot of this is. It's making an argument, but making that argument funny or absurd. And so, you know, I'll have people, like, who are my friends who are like, check me on that or give me their thoughts on that. There's also tons of unsolicited advice that I don't ask for. That's annoying. So I do my best to ignore most of that, but certainly there are people who, like, who shape the stuff, you know, just because I think no artist really lives in a void. You're affected by the things around you, the people around you.
One of your newer pieces that I saw and I watched was you pitching a new logo for the Washington Redskins. Why was that topic of interest to you, and how do you think that whole debate has been covered in the media?
Oh, I mean, that I mean, that particular topic is so interesting because it's one of the few, it's so, there's so much of the outward racism of America, like, it has been, like, in the media, has been washed away, which is good, but at the same time, there's still, like, these subtle kinds of racism you have to deal with, and that lead to these big discussions, but this is an over-the-top, like, this isn't even a, you know, this is one of those, under the idea of tradition, you have, like, an indigenous person's head being used as a mascot, and the name being so absurd, like the Redskins, like, there isn't much, it's hard to wash that away, that's a very clear thing, and yet you have people arguing tradition and arguing, and I say in the piece, like, yeah, your tradition's like 80 years old, that's one racist grandparent. It just, it's not that old of a thing, but it forces us, I think, it's a great point to confront, like, what this country was built on, and how awful that is, and the fact that there's any celebration of that. And people can claim it's tradition and honoring, but I don't know if that's really the best way to honor many different peoples, the First Nations. So, to me, that's just ripe. It's ripe for mockery. And I think my proposal, the severely sunburned white person, and allowing the Redskins to keep the name under the image of a severely sunburned white person, you know, that's another way to confront, well, okay, well, if you think the name is such a big part of your tradition, then why is the logo that important to you? You know, why not just keep the name and find another way to use it? So, you know, I feel like that's a great, I knew when I put that video out it was going to get some love and it was going to get some hate, and I knew that it was going to make some people really happy and some people unhappy, and that's usually a good sign for me that I'm making something good, that I'm making something interesting, because it's divisive, and if I can say something divisive that I feel is on the right side of the issue that I feel proud of, I know I've done a good job.
We've been talking a lot about oppression and race, and of course, on Monday, the jury just came down in Ferguson, and they decided not to indict Darren Wilson. And I just wanted to get your thoughts. Yesterday, Darren Wilson, the cop, came out and said it wouldn't have made a difference if Michael Brown was white. Do you have a response to that?
I find that kind of... The reason I find that so dishonest is, you know, I can't get into his head and I can't recreate the situation, but I know that there are so many examples of young black men being murdered by the police. Either murdered by the police or murdered by vigilantes out of fear. And so this man is saying this, and again, I can't get into his head and I can't get into the situation. I wasn't there, but this sounds familiar to me. Of, like, young black men being killed, you know, by vigilantes and cops, and mostly white cops, and mostly white vigilantes, and it's fear that drives that. And it's fear of someone who's, you know, who's black, fear of, you know, the idea, he called him a demon. You know what I mean? Like, would he have dehumanized a white person in the same way? He said, it looks like a demon. It. Like, that's such a shocking thing, and there's a history of that dehumanization of, like, people of color, particularly black people, in the United States. So, I find that, I wasn't there, but that certainly sounds dishonest. Sounds not in the, you know, like, especially in a police force that is highly racialized, where the majority of the people in that area are black, and the majority of the people policing and who are running the place are white. It's basically him saying, I'm colorblind, when we all know that every interaction that we have is somewhat racialized with everyone. Like, it's unfortunate, but that's what it's become. Everyone, you say, what is that person? It's in the back of my head, and I don't want it to be there, but it is. And so to him to say that, no, that didn't play, that's, how could that be? Because you definitely thought about who was in front of you, in addition to his size. You thought about that. It's also kind of amazing to shoot somebody that many times just fired him, and then I shot him in the head. The way he talked about it, it's like, you did kill a kid, right? You do realize it. He was 18. He just graduated from high school. He didn't see him as a kid. He didn't see him as a young person. None of that seemed to matter. I don't know. So.
Well, Your comedy is definitely leaves people thinking and talking, which is always a good thing if we can advance the conversation. Hurry, Kundabolu.
Yeah, that last piece didn't seem funny at all, to be honest. It seemed very depressing. The show will be significantly funnier on December on 5th. I promise you that. if I do talk about Ferguson, there'll be a clear comedic point of view involved and not... just, oh my God, isn't this depressing? the show isn't this depressing, but hold on, this part of it's funny. That's what I try to do. But man, yeah, I promise you, the tone will be more on the comedy side.
And you're playing December 5th at the Biltmore Cabaret here in Vancouver. The new album is Waiting for 2042, and it is out now. Hurry Kundabolu, thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, thank you very much.
Cheers, have a good one.
Hey, and that was Hurry Kundabolu. And once again, he'll be playing at the Biltmore this Friday. You can visit his website at harikondabolu.com. That's harikondabolu.com. And you can check out his Washington Redskins piece on YouTube and on upworthy.com. Okay, we have another song here from Twin Forks. This is the song Scraping Up the Pieces.
I made. I never had much money, but I got a little saved. Baby, leave the light on. I'll be coming over late. A face just like an angel. There's a lion in your eyes. You can tempt the devil, and I wouldn't be surprised. You believe in ghosts. You're the girl I love the most. You could have had a better man, but I'm the one you chose. So when I say I need you, I'm never gonna stop. Believe me, 'cause I mean it from the bottom of my heart. From the bottom of my heart, you're staring at it differently out in the light of day. I may have missed the party, but there's flowers on the way. You say no one needs to save you, and no one ever should. Put yourself together, boy, it'll only do you good. So when I say I need you, and I'm never gonna stop, believe me, 'cause I mean it from the bottom of my heart. But don't you ever doubt that I will get all I've got. I'll be scraping up the pieces from the bottom of my heart. I could go to rest on high, up in paradise forever, in the golden shining sky. It couldn't feel much different than the years I had alive, staring up into the heavens with you lying by my side. So when I say I need you, I'm never gonna stop. Believe me, 'cause I mean it from the bottom of my heart. Now don't you ever doubt that I will give it all I've got. I'll be scraping up the pieces from the bottom of my heart. Better man, but I'm the one you chose. So when I say I need you, and I'm never gonna stop, believe me, 'cause I mean it from the bottom of my heart. Now don't you ever doubt that I won't give it all I got. I'll be scraping up the pieces from the bottom of my heart. I'll be scraping up the pieces from the bottom of my heart. I'll be scraping up the pieces from the bottom of my heart. I'll be scraping up the pieces from the bottom of my heart.
That was Scraping Up the Pieces by Twin Forks.
Of Oryx. Hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So this is a relatively new project for you, and it drifts a little bit from sort of your earlier work. And I understand this was born out of you wanting to collaborate with a certain few musicians. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I've been picking up as I traveled with Dashboard. I meet one person or another, and I think to myself that'd be somebody I'd love to play with. And so eventually, that's who I assembled for bandmates for this band. And I keep cycling through some more friends that I had met on the road. So originally it was Jonathan and Ben and Susie. And then there's a handful of other people that have come in and out to join us. But originally it was those people that I met out on the road.
And I know from what I read, you got your start in the more punk rock scene. And this sort of borders more on alt folk country, however you want to describe it. Do you see similarities in those two styles?
I do. I mean, certainly in the. I think there's parallels in the subgenres of each of those genres, like the protest music of the folk variety versus the protest music of the punk variety, and you know. Also, it's very spirited. It's very also based around a sing-along mentality. It's often counterculture, despite how popular it is now. I think folk music and punk music is cyclical. It goes through periods of popularity and obscurity. And it maintains its focus no matter what.
Folk music has become such a broad area now from where it used to be 30, 40 years ago with, you know, the Dylans and the Donovans and the protests like that. How would you describe what you think folk music is today and where it's going?
It's difficult to say. I'm not sure how it's a good question. I think that, there's always going to be the most popular bands in a genre. So you're going to have a Mumford & Sons, and defining a scene, I guess. But then there's plenty of people under the radar that are also shaping the scene. It's a collaborative effort, scene-wide. So it's unpredictable. I can't tell you where it's going.
Talking of collaboration, I'm curious, is the writing process, the creative process for putting this album together, because it's not like it's a new band, it's a band of already established musicians. It could be considered a supergroup depending on how you want to define it. Did that make it easier or harder, do you think, for you to write it and put all that music together?
Didn't make it harder. It's the easiest record I've ever made, so I can only speak for myself. It seemed like it's the easiest time I've ever had making a record.
Your own personal writing process, how would you describe it?
I would describe it as a lot of it is just improvisation. And then, so sometimes I'll just like sing into a dictaphone. The words don't make any sense, but there's a lot, just maybe one phrase in there that anchors a whole song. And that's where, I guess, the artistry comes in. If you've just thrown in, you got lucky with a line somewhere in there, but if you can make a whole song out of that one line that resonates as powerfully as that accidental line, then doing the craft.
You talked about how this group started with wanting to collaborate with musicians you've met on your road, you know, on the road in your travels. How important is the touring, just the lifestyle of being on the road to you creatively?
Well, that's where you get to see. It's where you get to see the connection you're building with an audience. So I think it's paramount.
And I know, you know, you had been with Dashboard for many years, and I recently read something you said. It's not that you're not planning to make music with him, but that Twin Forks is kind of where your heart and soul is right now. And you talked earlier about music being cyclical. So how would you just describe your mindset, you know, your current approach towards life, if you will, and how it fits in with what you do creatively?
I'm not sure which is the engine there, which of those two things. I don't know if it's what I'm doing creatively, or it's more likely what I'm doing creatively is guiding what I'm doing with my life, to be honest with you. But, you know, songs to me are all things. You know, it's like listening to music is my escapism, writing music is my hobby and my job, and playing music is like how other people play video games, or I do play video games. You know, it's escapism. But when it starts to take shape and starts to become, once it starts to take shape, it starts to direct like a path of my life, at least for the near future. So, you know, big questions get raised as you're writing these songs. Are these songs? Oh, these are songs. Is this a record? Yes, this is a record. Are we a band? Yes, we're a band. That means we're going to go out and do this. What kind of band are we? We're the kind of band that's... Are we, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of different kinds of ways you can approach being a band. Our approach has always been, and I should say mine has always been, it's certainly the same, but this is like being in a band is... gives you an opportunity to come face to face with people you never would otherwise. I'm not talking about famous people, I'm talking about regular audience, like people like me that love to go to shows, love to hear music. And so, to me, we're out on the road, but it's not just to play for these people, it's to get to meet them, know them, thank them face to face.
But does it also, in a way, make you question or perhaps reevaluate some of the things that you previously thought about the way the world works, for say, in dealing with the, you know, you talked about escapism, and you know,
does music make you think differently? Yes, and I think that's the power of music, is it does make you see the world differently, as does any art. You know, it's a funny thing. It's art is any art. Fine art, music, movies. Ultimately, it's the consumer. The consumer is involved in the art. When I say consumer, it's the person perceiving the paint, like, you know, standing in front of the paint and painting and having their worldview changed by this thing for that very moment, even if it's just for that, only that moment. And on the other end of it, there's this peculiar thing about music that maybe is probably the same, I would say probably analogous to what people, actors in live theater probably experience. Whereas you might not, if you're in a movie or a television show, or if you are a painter, you're not there when the people are seeing your product. And then maybe I'm not there when they're hearing my product on record, but certainly when I go to play a show, they're then changing my worldview back. I mean, we're talking in small degrees, but nonetheless, I've heard songs and that weightlessness you feel almost sometimes, where you just like you're lifted out of the place you were and put in a new place from the power of the song you're listening to. I've been told my songs have done that to people. I've had many, many songs do that to me, other people's songs. But what's amazing, I think, is that once we're out here and we're playing live, it's the audience doing that to us. We're playing the songs, but they're interpreting it right there in the moment. And it can be shown through the way that they sing along, or the way that they clap along or clap after, the way that they laugh a little at a tongue-in-cheek line. And they are shaping the song in the very moment that it's being played. And it's exciting.
would you say that music and to the larger context of art as a whole, is it your opinion as much as it is an expression of who you are?
Is it my opinion? Is my music my opinion? I don't know if my music's my opinion. I really don't know. I don't know, because you can take on a character. You can observe the world the way you wish you could observe the world. You can experience feelings the way you really wish you could experience feelings. It gives you... it enables you... You're so, when you're writing a song, you're so fixated on this one singular aspect, right, that you're preternaturally able to embrace these feelings in a way that the world moves too quick, generally, for you to actually have that opportunity in real life, in day-to-day life.
And finally, would you say that you have a favorite song off the Twin Forks album?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. I would say, just bearing the way things go live, it's this tour. It changes, like, you know, could change night to night, but there's been a fun thing happening with a song called Kiss Me Darling, where the sing-along has become... It's just a song I didn't expect to have a big chanting sing-along. It's not really shaped that way, in my opinion. Or it wasn't, in my opinion. Now, in my opinion, I realize it clearly is, because they've shown it. That's how they've interpreted it. And so that's been the sleeper for this one.
Well, Chris Caraba, Twin Forks, thanks so much.
This has been great. Thank you.
And that was Chris Caraba of Twin Forks. My next interview features the directors of The Immortalists, David Alvarado and Jason Susberg. Science coming at ya.
Are David Alvarado and Jason Susberg, the directors of the bold new documentary film, The Immortalists. David, Jason, welcome to the program. Hello, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So I'm intrigued by this film, The Immortalists. How did it begin for you? I read that you guys had just had graduated Stanford and you were editing an experimental music video.
Yeah, that's right. David and I had the fortunate situation where we were editing this music video for hours and hours on end in the sub-basement of the music department. And so we were able to kind of bat ideas back and forth. And I had run across these characters, Aubrey, and a few of the other life extensionists in Silicon Valley doing a different film. And so we started talking to each other about what it would look like if we were to turn it into a feature film. And one thing led to another, and we were filming that October.
You guys both, I know, have an interest in sort of science and in science fiction. How do you feel that aspects of science have been portrayed in film and other media over the years? And what do you think, apart from it being a documentary, what do you think this film does differently?
Well, for us, this film, it does look at the science, and it does, you know, examine the idea of should we live forever? Is that even possible? What does that really mean? You know, what would the medical advancements mean? But the film is also unique because it really does look at it through the lens of these two scientists' lives. So it's not just the science, it's about the personal journey that these two men have dedicated their whole lives to in order to reverse aging.
Now, David, I know for you, you kind of got your start in punk and anarchy and being a rebel. And I'm wondering if you could relate to Aubrey and Bill somewhat, because they're kind of rebels in this field of science. They're going against the grain, if you will.
Yeah, I guess I could. I mean, you know, I'd like to drink a lot and live life, you know, fast and loose. So does Aubrey. So, you know, I'm definitely connected to him in that way. And, you know, Bill and Aubrey both, it's true, are very rebellious. You know, most people, myself included, just assume that we all grow old and die, and they right away from a very young age. Both
You know, and I had the fortune of talking to Aubrey a few years ago, and he was saying, you know, we're maybe about 10-15 years away. Did you get any sense from him when you were making the film about how far away a potential immoral person is?
Well, yeah, I think Aubrey was much cagier when we would ask this question because he didn't want to get, or he didn't want to be on the line for making a prediction that didn't come true. So he was much, you know, I guess more conservative than he had in the past. I think that it was in 2000, and, oh, in the 2000s, he said that the first person to live forever is in their 60s and will probably live to 1,000. And, you know, that was a big claim, and he kind of got burned for saying that. So he definitely said that he had a 50-50 chance for himself to cure aging. But he was really, he didn't really commit to an exact number. Bill thinks that he's 3 years away from curing aging. So they have different timelines for sure.
And I know Bill's big thing is this telomerase, I believe it's called. Did he give you a sense of what that is and how it works?
Yeah, the telomerase enzyme is something that's been known for decades, and, you know, we don't know everything about it, but we do know how some of its behaviors and the Harvard study that Bill was referencing, you know, took some genetically modified mice with modified shorter telomeres, applied the enzyme telomerase, and watched them exhibit signs of more youthful mice. And so those are mice, not humans, and those are genetically modified ones at that. So it's at best a proof of concept, as I understand it. So we know that there's this real enzyme and it really does do something, but we don't know to what extent it would actually help us cure aging. And if it would do so in humans, and that's what Bill is out trying to find out for himself.
Now, it's clear that not, in fact, that the majority of scientists don't agree with Aubrey and Bill. Why do you think that the science establishment is so resistant to the work of these two gentlemen?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty audacious goal. On the face of it, it reads like snake oil, and so people are quick to prejudge it. I also think that, like, you know, the medical profession tends to be a very conservative profession. They don't usually go out on limbs and make braggadocious statements. And, you know, science progresses really slowly. You know, we've been at a 60-plus-year-old war against cancer that has not been solved. So I think that the scientific community just doesn't want to be, you know, as bold as these two guys are. Also, I think that the idea is changing. We've seen, David and I, when we were making the film, have seen a lot of medical professionals and scientists who were coming out in favor of what Aubrey and Bill are standing for. Privately, in cocktail parties, there would be, you know, physicians in the room who would, you know, privately tell us that absolutely they think that this can happen and this is a great idea to tackle aging from a totality position holistically rather than, you know, targeting individual causes of aging like Alzheimer's and heart disease and cancer, but instead to target aging as a whole. So I think that there is a slow evolution going in the direction.
You know, with documentary filmmakers, depending on what style you are, you always have to be careful not to put your own opinion in a project often. How were you guys able to take a step back and say, this is Aubrey and Bill's story, and our opinion doesn't really matter in this case?
Well, I think there's different schools of thought about that. You know, for some people, putting a point of view into the documentary, the language of the film, is a certain style. It's a decision that they've made, and hopefully they're very obvious of how they're placing their point of view in the film. So, you know, we believe that that's a valid way to make a film. You know, what's immortalists that Jason and I maybe didn't even plan on, was that the film really does take a step back and let the two protagonists speak for themselves and then duke out against their ideas against the antagonists, which are these other very credible, reputable scientists who disagree for different reasons. So the ideas get challenged, but they get challenged from within the discussions that we ended up filming. And so we tried our best to present that objectively, but knowing full well that we had a subjective stance. We were there in the room trying to understand for ourselves what to make of all this.
You always hear the phrase, you know, scientific consensus thrown around, especially when you're talking about climate change. But does consensus in the scientific community actually exist? You're always going to have outliers like Aubrey and Bill around. So how do you go forward if there's not a true consensus in that matter?
Well, I think the history of science has shown that it's healthy to be skeptical. You know, that pushing back against ideas is how science works. You can't just declare something to be so, you know, say that it's a mission you have and then go out and expect all the funding to come in and the scientists support it. Scientists are very skeptical, and it's the most, I guess, ruthless method we know in the pursuit of truth. And so that's a good thing. And so it's good that people are pushing back on Aubrey and Bill. I think it's positive. But also the history of science has shown that if your idea is correct, you know, radical ideas that sound crazy at first, if that idea is correct and it survives the scrutiny of methodology of science, then it'll out itself, and scientists will eventually agree with it, as being the case. So that's the interesting thing for us, is we want to see what happens over the next, you know, few decades with regard to life extension.
Well, the interesting thing is, I find, is that, you know, since the late 19th century, human life expectancy has doubled. Is that a fact that work in Aubrey and Bill's favor, do you think?
Well, yes and no. I mean, absolutely, life expectancy has gone up considerably since basically the mid-1800s. It has doubled even, I think, from the first part of this century. So, the latter half of the 20th century. However, there is like a theoretical maximum age, which is governed by how long our telomeres are, which is the tips of the chromosome. And that theoretical maximum is 122 years, which was the age of a French woman. She's like the Jean Clément, she's like the oldest person that has been documented to have ever existed. So that's sort of the theoretical upper end, the ceiling of how long we can live. So even though we have been increasing life expectancy steadily, there's a wall that we really can't break through until we solve issues like telomeres.
Well, you use the phrase hypothetically, and I'm wondering if Bill specifically, because he's the one that seems to deal with telomeres, if he has actually found a way to test the longevity of an organism or a cell like that.
Theoretical. It's a theoretical maximum age. Bill himself, he tests. He's not even working in mammals, actually. They're working with organisms that are not rats, not rabbits. So eventually, he'll take whatever research he's doing now currently, and he'll take that to a mammal study where they'll be able to really test it there. So while he's really bullish about curing age in the next 2 or 3 years, they're still pretty far away from doing animal studies.
Now I know initially you guys were going to do this in 3D, and then you scrapped that and went with more traditional filmmaking. Why did you decide to scrap 3D, and what do you make of the whole hype surrounding 3D filmmaking?
Yeah, that's a really good question. For us at the very beginning of making the film, we didn't know how to visualize something that doesn't yet or possibly will never exist. How can you visualize in a visual medium like documentary this thing, this scientific a camera that we can afford, and we decided to try to experiment with that. You know, the way that the Immortalist is now is you see the animation as the characters are explaining their science. You sort of see that science dancing around in the frame in front of them as they're interacting with it. And that came out of the idea that if there's a three-dimensional space for this sci-fi, futuristic type science could be shown visually, then that would be maximizing the use of this new form of a cheaply produced 3D documentary. But then we decided to get out of that because this was back in 2010, and the rise of the DSLR cameras that produce these beautiful images for low cost, which is so tempting both aesthetically and as far as the price point went. So we made the decision happily to go back to 2D, and we're very happy with that decision.
And that was David Alvarado and Jason Susburg. The new film is The Immortalist, is out in theaters now. This has been Endeavors on 79.1 FM. My thanks to David and Jason. My thanks to Chris Caraba of Twin Forks. And, of course, my big thanks to Hari Kondabolu. You can catch a show Friday night at the Biltmore. Stay tuned for the Jambalaya at 6 and the Swan Song at 7. We're going to take you out with Twin Forks' Kiss Me Darling. This goes out to my love, Courtney Penner. And we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
So kiss me, darling. It's been a long time. So kiss me, darling. It's been a long time. It's been a long time since I saw you in the village playing mandolin. Something in your singing made my burdens lift. Hanging on to every word to cross your lips. Feels like a long way gone, but I can still remember how you sang that song. Smiling like nobody'd ever done you wrong.